Hey, Bill Nye, the science guy here.
This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams.
I'm Mr. Didi, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour. I command you to listen now, or I will smite you.
Yes, I am a sound scientist. Came to evaluate the evidence on a closed case, highly classified, confidential, in a race against the clock.
Hey, listeners, it's Jess Constantine.
And Todd Stiefel.
And you're listening to The Humanist Hour, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association.
Humanism is the concept of being good without God.
So, Todd, it's January, which to me means it's time for focusing on new beginnings, new ventures, new projects, things of that nature. And that's what we're going to do this month on our show. We've got two guests who have both been on our show previously, but today they're going to talk about some new projects that they're working on. So we've got Greg Epstein, who is both the humanist chaplain at Harvard, as well as a New York Times bestselling author for his book, Good Without God. And he's going to be talking about a new initiative of the Harvard Humanist Chaplaincy called the Humanist Community Project.
We also have Daryl Ray, Dr. Daryl Ray, who's going to be giving us a little update on something he talked about with us last year, which is the concept of religion, sex, and God, and his new book on the subject.
Yeah, but before we talk about our guest, Todd, let's fill our listeners in on some good news in our movement, because we need that, right?
Let's spread the good news. Wait, isn't that what the Bible does?
That's the good word, I think, or the Bible's the good book, I think. I don't know, Todd. You're asking the wrong person. Anyway, the good news, though, is that we've been talking about for the last several months about this case with the Cranston, Rhode Island high school student, Jessica Alquist, who took her school basically to court in an effort to get them to take down the prayer banner that was hanging up in their school. And a couple days ago, we learned that she won that case.
She did indeed. They took down the school prayer because somehow public schools don't seem like they need school prayer. So yeah, heck of a brave girl. My gosh, you know, to stand up for people's constitutional freedoms in the face of really staunch opponents who are trying to claim the moral high ground, which is somewhat ironic since apparently they stand on the un-American side of the equation.
Yeah, it's kind of sad, actually. She's facing some backlash from her peers at school, so much that she's actually decided to sort of stop attending just for the time being, not a dropout or anything like that, just like a little leave of absence. So listeners, it'd be great if you could show Jessica some of your support. And there are two ways that you can do that. One is, of course, you can call our listener comment line to give her some words of encouragement. So definitely feel free to do that at 202-618-1371. The other thing that you can do is purchase a t-shirt called the Evil Little Thing t-shirt. And you can find that at freethoughtblogs.com. This is an initiative of several activists in the Freethought community. Among them is Hemant Mehta, the friendly atheist. So the Evil Little Thing t-shirt is being sold, and some proceeds from the sales are going to a scholarship fund on behalf of Jessica Alquist. And you may have heard the story that the Rhode Island state representative actually referred to Jessica as an evil little thing, which is why that's what's on the shirt. So definitely show your support. Sure, that we're proud of her bravery, and just to let her know that she's not alone in this humanist community.
So on the topic of good news, there was also another big win. This one was actually by the ACLU in my hometown in North Carolina, where there have been cases going back and forth for a few years now, the ACLU versus the Forsyth County Board of Commissioners, because that Board of Commissioners has been insisting on having sectarian prayers in Jesus' name for all their meetings, which not too surprisingly made people who are not religious feel excluded, or maybe somebody of any other faith, Judaism, Islam, etc.
These are before government meetings?
Yes. Government-led sectarian prayers in Jesus' name at the start of government meetings. Mm-hmm. It's been a five-year legal battle going on, and the ACLU, the good guys in this case, have won consistently, and the last step was it got appealed by the Forsyth County and their allies in this, the Alliance Defense Fund, which is essentially a radical Christian legal group that works very hard to undermine the Constitution and gay rights. But they appealed it all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court rejected even hearing the case. So the victory at the Fourth Circuit stands, and those prayers are no longer going to be allowed to be sectarian. So that's a pretty sweet victory for church and state.
Yeah, it is.
Some good news to start the year off.
I like it.
Hooray.
All right, Todd. Well, let's go ahead and start our show now. Why don't you introduce our first guest, Greg Epstein, for our listeners.
Greg is the humanist chaplain at Harvard University. He's also famous around our circles for his book, Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe. And so he's a humanist rabbi with his ordination from the International Institute for Secular Humanistic Judaism. I studied in Jerusalem and Michigan, and actually has studied Chinese. He holds a BA degree in Chinese, which is kind of cool, and yeah, master's in theology from Harvard.
So Greg's here today to talk about the Humanist Community Project, which is the humanist chaplaincy at Harvard's initiative to bridge the multicultural and multigenerational gaps that they're finding in the humanist community, and that's both globally and locally. All right, so listeners, we're here with Greg Epstein. Greg, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be back. Great to be back with you guys.
So, Greg, this is now our third time speaking on this podcast. We had you first on our show about 5 years ago when you took over the humanist chaplaincy at Harvard University. And we had you on our show just a few years ago when you released your book, Good Without God. So why don't you give our listeners an idea about what you're doing these days and why you're on our show today?
Well, okay, so our organization, the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard, has just sort of launched a new initiative that we are really happy about, and it's called the Humanist Community Project, and it sort of expands the scope of the work that we have been doing here on this campus over the past few years. And the idea is basically that there have been so many developments over the past few years or so in the humanist and free thought and atheist movement that have given us greater visibility, have given us greater opportunities to reach more people. And there are so many people around the country that are gravitating towards this way of thinking, a way of thinking about the world that's freer, that is open to reason and critical thinking and critical inquiry and all of that. But there has not yet been as much done as I would like to see to really develop a sense that we can have institutions of our own that are sort of alternatives to traditional religion that can provide people with the same kind of experiences that they would be looking for in a congregation or religious community if they were to join it, if they wanted to join some kind of community or congregation but didn't want the theology, the belief in gods and the supernatural and all of that. And what we're about to do is launch a project that's going to study all the different ways that people are forming these kinds of communities around the country and even around the world right now, and try to move towards a sense of having people be more aware of what their options are, of what it would really look like to have a successful community. So I can tell you a lot of the different stories about what we've been studying so far and what we're planning on studying and whatever. But basically, it's launching a laboratory so that in the next few years, we can develop a sense that there really is a community for secular and non-religious and humanist people wherever they might live, not just on our own campus.
That sounds pretty comprehensive. How long is this project going to be, and what are the different phases of the project?
We're envisioning about 3 years of working on what we're working on right now, which is basically just going around the country virtually and to some extent physically, and taking a look at the different innovations that people have been coming up with. Because, you know, the thing is, nowadays with the internet and with social media, the idea of launching a project that can influence thousands, even millions of people, and provide a new kind of service, a new kind of community to people, is so much more possible than ever before. And so, you know, I've had a chance to study some of the history of humanism and the history of the free thought movement. And what you see is that these ideas that people like us believe in, the idea that there is this one natural world and that we have to be skeptical about any kind of claim of anything that goes beyond what we can see and experiment with and touch and feel, et cetera. And that values come from human experiences and come from the sense of human dignity and the desire to spread it universally. Those ideas go back to ancient times, and they've always been with humanity throughout all of human history. There have been little minority groups, minority thinkers that have adopted those views. But now we have an opportunity with new technology and you know, sort of new social climate to really make that into a mass movement. And that has excited me since the day that I found humanism. But what I felt, you know, joining the humanist movement was a lot of the organizations that I found and the local organizations that I found, and even to some extent some of the experiences that I had with national organizations, getting involved in them over the last dozen years or so, I sometimes felt like we were more of a there is no God debating society than an actual community. And I felt like the reason why my family had participated in some religious activities when I was growing up as a kid, and why so many people that I know and that I know of still participate in religious communities despite having very secular worldviews and very naturalistic worldviews, is that those communities provide something for people. They've evolved to do it. I mean, you know, if we believe that the world evolved to the place where it is today on the basis of natural selection, why wouldn't communities and congregations and religious movements have selected for themselves to do some things that are actually worthwhile for people, even for people who don't believe a lot of the supernatural stuff that you would find in them? And so, you know, I found people want to join often communities that provide them with really good education for their kids about what it is to be a moral person, what it is to be a good person, what it is to connect with one's family. People want to go to a place that can provide them with a meaningful ceremony when they're getting married or when they're, you know, when somebody in the family is dying or when a new baby is born. And I can go on and on, and maybe we'll get a chance to discuss some of the other possibilities that are out there.
Sure. I'd definitely like to do that, Greg. You mentioned that you've been traveling both sort of virtually and physically. Can you tell us some of the things that you've seen out in the country or out in the world so far?
I recently got a chance to attend the International Ethical Humanist Conference in Norway this summer. And what I found there was the Norwegian Humanist Association has almost 100,000 members, which if you looked at the percentage of the population, that would be like saying that the American Humanist Association would have about 4 or 5 million members. And that would be like paying, signed on the dotted line, wearing the T-shirt members, which would be a sea change, which would allow us to do so much in American politics, which would allow us to never again be discriminated against in some of the ways that we are today, et cetera. So I started asking around, well, what kind of programs does the Norwegian Humanist Association do to get that level of influence in its society? And you'd think, well, Norway's a really secular country, so maybe they have programs where they talk about secularism and they talk about the separation of the Norwegian church, which is still a very real thing, and the state government. And they do to some of that to some extent. But what I found was the biggest single program that the Norwegian humanists do is confirmation ceremonies for humanist youth. And so every year, 10,000 kids from ages 13 and 14 in Norway have a humanist confirmation ceremony where they study for a year and they study humanist ethics and values. They attend a seminar each month. And one of the seminars that they attend is really cool. There's an immigration problem in Norway where there are a lot of youth refugees trying to get in, and they have a very difficult experience. And so the Norwegian humanists take their kids out into the woods for a weekend where it's cold and it's dark, and they take them out overnight and they show them in a camp. Yeah, seriously, what it's like to be a refugee. They give the kids the experience of, you know, we say as humanists that the golden rule is how we determine our ethics, right? But we know that you've got to have experiences with being in somebody else's shoes. And so humanists really put their money where their mouth is in Norway, and they say, we're going to show you, we're going to teach you, we're going to show you that humanism is about having an experience of what it's like to be in another person's shoes. And that results in this incredibly vibrant, powerful movement in Norway where, again, I mean, you just couldn't think to challenge the separation of church and state in that country in some of the ways that you can hear today. Just another quick example that, you know, that really fascinated me. In Great Britain today, there are 120 members of British Parliament who are signed on the dotted line members of the Humanist Caucus, which is amazing. That's 120 members of the official government that say, you know, we are humanists, we support the British Humanist Association, et cetera. As you guys know, we have in the U.S. still one today, and there's so much potential for more, right? But I asked my friend Andrew Copson, who's the director of the British Humanist Association, how is it that you got that many members of Parliament to sign up for what you were doing? And he said in his inimitable accent, which I won't even try, Andrew's a brilliant guy, and he just sounds great when he says it. But he said to me, look, it's very easy. We just explained to each member of Parliament that in the past year, 300,000 people in Great Britain attended a humanist wedding. And that's good enough for them. And I think it would really be good enough for a lot of our politicians, too. And so we can adopt some of the practices that are going on in Europe where they're investing more in training humanist celebrants to do weddings and funerals and that sort of thing. So one of the first programs that we're launching for the Humanist Community Project this coming March is a training session with a scholar who I think is the best expert in the U.S. today. Her name is Miriam Jarris, on humanist ceremonies, on what it's like to create weddings, funerals, baby namings, and even confirmation ceremonies for humanists of all different backgrounds and cultures. And so we're bringing Miriam Jarris, who is a secular humanist rabbi and professor at the International Institute for Secular Humanist and Judaism. We're bringing her to Harvard to do a weekend seminar that's going to be open to people from anywhere who want to be humanist celebrants or who want to, who maybe are humanist celebrants, but maybe perform one wedding a year and haven't really been trained that well how to do it, but want to really learn in more depth, what is it like to create humanist community for people and for their families?
So is that something that you'll be working with the humanist celebrants from the Humanist Society on?
So what we're doing, that program is something that we're offering as the Humanist Community Project, and we have basically, you know, we'll just basically invite folks from the Humanist Society and the Humanist Institute who want to attend to come down. I'd like to work with those groups more directly in the future because, you know, those are some of the groups that are doing some of the most important work in the movement right now. The Humanist Institute, as you guys know, and I mean, I'm very much aware it's now part of the American Humanist Association, is training leaders of the future, and then the Humanist Society, that's our group of clergy or the equivalent of clergy, let's say, who are going to be responsible in the future, I'd like to think, for performing those tens and tens of thousands of ceremonies that could help us, that could be one of the things that really helps us to develop a more vibrant movement. But, you know, what we did was, you know, since we have our own space at Harvard and we have access to some really great people on our campus and through just sort of the work that our community has been up to, you know, we figured we'd start by just offering some programs that we can offer that can be supplements to the organizations that are already out there. And then, you know, hopefully we can, you know, over the next few years, really figure out how to grow all these different organizations together.
What are the dates going to be for that celebrant training?
That celebrant training is March 2nd to the 4th. And we've already got some information up about it at harvardhumanist.org. And I think by the time this podcast launches, we'll have some detailed information about what it's going to cover, how to perform weddings, funerals, baby namings, et cetera. And again, I mean, these are topics that are taught in different parts of the country from time to time by different organizations. But number one, the faculty member that we're bringing in to teach this one is just fantastic. She was my teacher, and she also, you know, is a colleague of Ben Biber, who you guys recently had on your podcast. And she just brings such a passion to this idea that, you know, you can create. She's an expert, for example, in intercultural marriages and helps people all over the country, and has helped hundreds and hundreds of, I don't even know what the number is, to have wedding ceremonies that bring together Christian and Jewish backgrounds, or even Jewish and Muslim, or, you know, Christian and Hindu, or what, you know, there's so many different cultural backgrounds that people come from, or even within two different types of Christianity or two different types of Judaism, where, you know, people have the same philosophy. They're both secular. They're both humanists. But they've got two different families that have two different sets of expectations of what life is going to be like for that family, and what the ceremony should be like, and what people are supposed to say and do. Miriam is just the expert on how to teach folks to deal with those things and to create more meaningful celebrations for humanists in a country, the U.S., where we have more diversity in terms of culture and history and heritage than anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, that's great, Greg. I think that that working with the celebrants is a great way to sort of work with people who will then reach, you know, hundreds and thousands of people. So that's a great approach, I think. So you have the sort of celebrant training aspect of your program, the research aspect. What else are you hoping to do and accomplish with the Humanist Community Project?
You guys were talking a few weeks ago on your podcast about Thanksgiving, right? And about, I think, Todd, you were saying something about saying grace and the idea that you know, that idea of saying grace or holding hands or singing some sort of song before a meal would probably give most of us humanists some kind of case of the heebie-jeebies. But at the same time, there is something positive potentially in the idea of before maybe a meaningful meal, or to have some little tradition before you eat with another person, where you reflect on what you're grateful for. You're grateful for the food. You're grateful for the fact that you have the opportunity to be there, right? And that's something that we know as a religious practice. But, you know, just like you and your family, you guys are creating something there, a sort of secular tradition for yourselves. One of the things that I want our Humanist Community Project to study is that there are just dozens and dozens and dozens, probably hundreds or thousands of little traditions like that being created by individuals and by groups of humanists all over the country, all over the world. And we can now begin to start to bring those kind of traditions together and build from them this sort of coherent movement where now if people could know us humanists for the little things like that we do, and also the big things that we do, the big community service projects, like the fact that humanists are going all around the world and all around the country now, serving local communities, figuring out how to help underprivileged kids or the homeless or disaster victims or people with cancer. If we could start to become known for projects like that, that got more and more successful because we put our focus into developing them as a movement, then, you know, and so that could be our sort of calling card, as opposed to just the fact that we don't believe in a God, or that, you know, we are against religious policies in the government, which of course we are. But if we could be known for the positive stuff, then I think we can really trigger that huge network lighting up of people who would be supporters of our cause, even if they themselves weren't humanists. The kind of environment that we've created in progressive parts of America now around GLBT rights, where somebody like me, as a straight ally of the GLBT community, would say, you know, I have dozens of friends, you know, who are in that community, and I know them, and I've been to some of their functions. You know, like my friend James in our community sings in the Gay Men's Chorus and invited us all to come down. And we all, you know, went and watched that, and we were like, yeah, this is a really fun show. If humanists can create things like that in our local communities for people to come see and take part in, we're going to build a movement that's going to be huge in the 21st century, and it's going to become a major, major part of American life. So we're just, the Humanist Community Project is about studying that. It's about becoming a laboratory to put those best practices into action in our local community at and around Harvard's campus, and to help be a resource for people in other parts of the country that want to learn how best to start their own communities, or, you know, once they have joined a community, how to grow their community, or, you know, any other aspect of humanist community life.
You started talking about choirs and the like, and I was thinking, what would a humanist or what would a humanist choir sound like? What would they sing? And the first thing that went through my head is, mine eyes have not seen the coming of the glory of the Lord.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, you know, this is the issue. And this is, you know, it is funny. And it's kind of how we've allowed ourselves to be framed. We have a lot of posts. Again, I'll mention James Croft, who is a doctoral candidate at Harvard, and he's our research and education fellow for the Humanist Community Project. And he's got a bunch of posts that are really worth reading up at the Humanist Community Project site, which is harvardhumanist.org, about how important it is to frame humanist values in a way that people will get them, that people will really understand what it is that we're trying to do as humanists in the country, what it is that we're trying to stand for, and why, if the world were a little bit more humanistic, it actually might be a little bit more compassionate, a little bit more just, a little bit more fair, and a little bit, you know, more supportive of the diversity of humans that are out there. And so, anyway, you know, one thing that we've sort of done with framing is we've kind of presented ourselves, and with music and other things, like the way that Steve Martin and his chorus, you know, once presented in a song. You ever hear that song that they did called Atheists Ain't Got No Songs or whatever it is, right? Where, you know, that sort of, you know, that the barbershop quartet type sound, and it's, you know, well, atheists have no songs, but, you know, it's okay because they get to sleep in late on Sundays, which is true. And by the way, even I work at an atheist or humanist organization. I still sleep in a little late on Sundays before I go into work to our community meetings. But at the same time, there's more to the possibility of having music than that. I feel like music and art, along with things like architecture, poetry, dance, drama, these are, to me, some of the most important aspects of what I think of as humanism. Because to me, what humanism is all about is the fact that the world is so often an unfair, unjust place that is not the way that we would want it to be, if we could imagine it to be the way that we, you know, that we would like it to be. And so art, creating art, is something that humanists can do to take our imagination and shape the world into a more beautiful place than it is. And so, you know, that's what a lot of my favorite artists are doing. They're doing something that's really humanistic. And, you know, other humanist organizations are actually taking this and running with it. So the British Humanist Association does have its own choir, actually. And, you know, one of the songs that they would sing would be a song like Do You Realize by the Flaming Lips. So, you know, but the point is that there really is a lot that we can do with music and art. And so one of the things that people will be able to see on our website as the weeks and months go on is we're going to be looking at some of the best music and art that is being created. And you guys looked at Shelley Siegel, right? Mm-hmm. Last week, or last month, rather.
Yep.
And just trust me, there's a lot of great content out there like that. I got a chance with a student of mine, Walker Bristol, to interview a Texas rock band called Quiet Company for the upcoming Humanist magazine. And Quiet Company has just released a whole album that is some of my favorite rock music to have come out in the past few years or so. Has kind of that sound of maybe The National or Sufjan Stevens or something like that. But it's a completely humanist album that's really inspiring. And we talked to the lead singer of the band, Taylor Muse, and asked him about music and community. And he, you know, as a rock star, basically said, look, community is the most important aspect of humanism. You know, that's why people in my family value religion so much. That's why I wanted to try to create humanist music, was to help people have more of a sense that there's an actual community out there of humanists that they can be part of, and that it's inspiring. And so it's just been so much fun for me to see the transition from, you know, I wrote a book about humanism and got a chance to travel around the country and talking to people about it. But, you know, to see that what most people, you know, who are interested in getting more involved in humanism seem to be looking for is a way to connect in a more in-depth way with, you know, in their local area, with other people who are like-minded and have a sense of a positive community. And it doesn't mean that, like, they want to come every Sunday and be lectured to and have some dude in a funny hat that's the Pope of humanism, say, I will now tell you what to do. But nobody's ever wanted that, and that's never been what any of this stuff has been about. It's just about a grassroots effort to make humanism better and to make our whole society better.
So aside from the lack of pointy hats, how are the communities you're going to be building going to be different than what you could experience in church?
Even in our community, where there is somebody who has this title of chaplain, which I know everybody, a lot of people out there think is a very scary title because it sounds so gosh darn religious. And, you know, and I sometimes, you know, feel that way myself. But even in a community like ours, where, you know, we have professional staff that are working on facilitating a community in the way that you might think religious communities do, none of us, not myself and not any of the members of the staff that I've been incredibly fortunate enough to be able to hire in the past 2 years, are playing this role of we get up and we tell you what to do, or we even tell you everything you need to know about what humanism is. What we're there to do is facilitate groups, whether it's groups of undergraduate students at our college or graduate students, or increasingly just people from the general local community and virtual communities that are following us, that we're there to make sure that the best possible conversation is happening. And so what I get a chance to do as that professional facilitator role is to meet with people who are interested in humanism and want to see a more active community and talk to them about how they can get more involved and give them opportunities or offer them opportunities. So, for example, we've now got, now that we have our own space in Harvard Square, we've got two different groups meeting every single week now, where the focus of what they meet about is humanism and mindfulness. And mindfulness is just this idea that you can become more aware of your own emotions. You can become more aware of your own thinking, and you can use that awareness that you can cultivate as a skill to improve the quality of your relationships with others and to improve your own inner experience of what it's like to be you and live your own life, and that actually has real benefits for society. And this is being studied by neuroscientists and by psychiatrists and all sorts of researchers. And it's great. So what we do is we use the space. And my role is to meet with some of the leaders and to help them, facilitate the group and to help them recruit more people for the group and that sort of thing. They meet, they get together, they sit and meditate for 20 or 30 minutes, which basically just means sitting quietly, being aware of your own breathing, and relaxing in a very sort of, according to one or more sort of special techniques, but very secular techniques. And then afterwards, people go around, they talk about it, and they say, how was that? Did that work well for you? People kind of crowdsource, like, well, that was really sort of weird for me to sit like that. How can I do it more effectively? Was I doing it right? And people help each other. And then after you've done that, people go around and talk about what's going on in their lives. So I hear stories all the time in these groups about, well, my spouse or somebody really close in my family is dying of cancer or is going through a really tough time and I don't know what to do about it, or I am, or and people get to share that stuff with other people in a way that they normally wouldn't. We get a little isolated, don't you guys think, in society today and in these American cities where we're online a lot and we're working a ton. And our friends from college are often spread out around the country. And sometimes it can be nice to have a place that's not religious where you can go and find people who want to do meaningful stuff together.
Sometimes you want to go where everybody knows you.
Well, there's that too. Yeah. I mean, I would also say that there's really good sociological data on this. The sociologist Robert Putnam, who's also here at Harvard, did this big study called American Grace of American Religion, and basically found, among other interesting things, it's referred to as sort of the Kinsey study of American religion, and it's a very thorough piece of research, he found that religious Americans, Americans that are, you know, that are members of congregations, are what he called better neighbors than their secular counterparts. That these religious Americans are more likely to give up a seat on a bus. They're more likely to donate blood. They're more likely to spend time with a friend who's feeling down. But that has nothing to do with religion, religious belief, rather, because total atheists who are attending religious congregations, let's say because they're going with their spouse, are experience all those benefits, all those positive qualities. But total believers who are not going to congregations, who are not getting involved in community, or go to a congregation but just sit in the pews by themselves, don't really experience any of those positive attributes or benefits. And so the idea is that these communities can actually do something positive for people, and we get a chance now to study how humanists can steal, borrow, or otherwise utilize some of the best techniques that are out there in these congregations for our own movement's benefit.
We've got a lot of humanist spouses and significant others going to religious services because their significant other goes. And if we're going to truly be effective with humanist communities, eventually we're going to get to the point where we have humanists going to our services and they're bringing their religious significant others along with them to our events. What are your thoughts on how to do that so that they feel welcome and they don't start getting isolated by discussions of lack of God or mocking religion and the like?
Yeah, I mean, that to me is a really wonderful possibility that we actually see happening in our own community. And I, you know, growing up with humanistic Jewish, I didn't grow up with it, but coming up in the movement with humanistic Jewish congregations, I've seen a lot of that there as well, where you can actually develop a community where people will bring their non-humanist partners and friends, and those people will actually enjoy it. And yeah, it starts with, to me, having a community that's primarily positive as opposed to primarily negative. And to me, that means a community that is primarily about saying, these are the things that inspire us. These are the things that make life better. And these are the things that we get excited about to do together, as opposed to, this is the stuff that we disbelieve in. This is the stuff that we think is horrible and terrible, and needs to be wiped from the face of the earth. And by the way, there are ideas and abuses that need to be wiped from the face of the earth. And one of the activities that we can get together and do, is political activism. And political activism where we challenge, the religious right, and we say, we're not going to stand for discriminatory policies. We're not going to stand for anti-human, inhumane policies, anti-women policies, anti-gay policies. We can do all of that as a humanist activity. We might do it more effectively, though, when we actually invite our religious neighbors alongside of us, you know, to come on and do it with us. Because the fact is, we've actually got more allies who call themselves religious than we have enemies. On almost all of those issues, and we can work with them. And so rather than wanting to just have this debate again and again and again, because I think I've even talked about some of these things on the Humanist Hour before, we wanted to try to create some initiatives that would actually, you know, lead to more action along these lines. And so one of the programs of the Humanist Community Project is another one that has its own name. We figured, you know, why not start naming things, and maybe the ideas will catch on a little bit. We're calling it VIA, or Values in Action. And the idea of the word VIA is it's by way of. It's a means to. Our VIA program is a program that encourages humanists to organize community service projects that we invite our religious neighbors to come along and work with us on. And so, for example, we've had a couple of big programs on Harvard's campus with this VIA program where we've packaged 30,000 meals for hungry or food insecure kids in our region. And we've had hundreds of Harvard students and just members of our local communities come out to do these events. And we're surrounded by these huge bags of rice, and soy protein and vegetables and dried vegetables and nutrients and packaging supplies and whatever. And you'll have a diverse group of people that really looks and feels diverse. And you can go and see the photos on our Facebook page at Harvard Humanist. And we're working together with Christians, you know, evangelicals and Catholics and Jews and Baha'is and Zoroastrians and Muslims. The Islamic Society at Harvard came down for one of these events and brought us a little check for $100 signed from the Harvard Islamic Society to the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard. Aww. Which I just thought was such a great moment. I mean, it's people are coming to us. They're coming into a room where we've got our humanist posters up and we're very clear about who we are, and they're just getting involved with us to help human beings in general. And that's an example that I feel like we can set. It's not that hard for people in other cities to do it. There are volunteer groups through the Foundation Beyond Belief that are doing stuff like this. And, Todd, I know that you've been really passionate about this and you've been a leader in some of this. I don't know how much you've talked about some of the work that you're going to be doing along these lines, but these are some of the projects that excite me the most. And if we can study how to do them best, we're on our way to a movement that I think can reach millions.
Do you have a plan for working with organizations like the American Humanist Association who, like, we have those membership groups sort of across the country? So it seems like you're getting some good information to try and sort of, do you have a way of integrating that information into the groups that already exist?
Yeah. I mean, and this is really important, and I've been meeting with different leaders in different humanist and secular organizations around the country over the last few months talking about this. I'm hopeful that the project that we're working on, the Humanist Community Project, can just be one engine that generates some enthusiasm for this kind of work around the country. I think that there are all kinds of great humanist and free thinking and secular organizations cropping up now. And so, you know, those of us who came up, 10, 15 years ago, in a movement where some of us really weren't sure where things were headed. And now I think that there's just a lot of positive energy and a lot of excitement. I'm hopeful that what we can do now is develop a sense that you can really build a community and we can really develop positive habits and positive practices for doing that. What we haven't tried to do is go and sort of sit down with, the five people that we need to sit down with and have a powwow and say, this is how all humanist communities are going to look forevermore. It's just that's so far from our thinking, and I think it's pretty far from the American Humanist Association's thinking, as I understand it, and a lot of the good people that I've talked to. But I've had really good conversations with folks there at AHA and elsewhere, where to me the goal is just, study this as much as possible over the next few years, work together collaboratively all the time, whether it's at conferences or, through our podcasts or, creating programs together, and just sort of chip away at this notion that we can't have communities without God, one success story at a time. I know that, doing this podcast, I'm going to continue to hear from folks who are associated with AHA, and I'm just really glad to have the opportunity to work with you all and just to be part of this process.
Well, that's great, Greg. And of course, we're happy to have you on our show, as always. Is there anything that you want to say to our listeners about how they can get involved and what they should be looking out for?
If you're following our work, what you're going to look for in terms of success down the road is just more humanist community in general for more people, not for any one organization, but just as a movement, as a phenomenon. And so, let us know your ideas. If, there's an email address that you can email us at from the site. If you want to write for us, if you want to contribute, if you've got ideas, if somebody in your city, whether it's you or anybody else, is doing something about humanism, about secularism, that you feel could be a great model for others around the country, let us know about it and let's advance the discussion. Let's really get this going now. Let's never again accept the idea that you know, we are just a marginal voice and we don't have anything positive to offer. Let's make the new paradigm that we do have something positive to offer, that when we quote statistics about millions of non-religious people, we're actually providing something for those people, and we're building a movement that represents them in all of their positivity, in all of the rich heritage, heritage that humanists bring to American life.
I think the work you're doing is fantastic, and I'm really looking forward to seeing more communities popping up and seeing them provide more resources and services that are a great alternative to religion. I do have one last question back to the concept of humanist ceremonies like namings and weddings. Like, can you walk our listeners briefly through what a humanist exorcism would look like?
Oh man. I don't know. Because I think that the first one I'll get involved with, I won't be performing it necessarily. I think it might get performed on me. So yeah, you know, there's that de-baptism ceremony, right, where you can get the blow dryer out. But what do you think about an exorcism, guys?
My guess is it's exactly like a Catholic exorcism. You say a bunch of words and nothing happens.
Well, yeah, hopefully there's part two of that ceremony. It's a little bit more constructive then.
Well, thanks for being on the show, and I look forward to seeing you at the Celebrant training in March 2nd through 4th.
Thanks again so much to you guys for all the great work you're doing and for the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
All right. Sure. Take care.
Bye. That was best-selling author and Harvard humanist chaplain, Greg Epstein.
You can learn more about the Humanist Community Project at harvardhumanist.org.
You can also learn more about humanist chaplaincies across the country at humanistchaplaincies.org.
Additionally, listeners, we'll have links to all of these things on our website, which is thehumanisthour.org.
That's right, Todd. We'll have archives to previous shows, which you can listen to and read about. We'll have the link to our Facebook page. We'll have our listener comment line.
202-618-1371. We'd love to hear from you with your thoughts, comments, questions, or ideas for future shows and guests.
And one last thing, while you're at thehumanisthour.org, take a look at episode number 63, Sex and Secularism. And you might remember that we had Dr. Daryl Ray on our show, and he talked about a study that he conducted where he asked secularists about their sex life.
And Daryl's going to be joining us again for this show to give us an update on what he's been doing and talk about his brand new book called Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality.
All right. So Dr. Daryl Ray, thank you so much for being on our show again.
Well, great to be back, guys.
So you were on our show a few months ago for our sex episode, where we talked about the study that you did about sex and God and how religion sort of, how people's relationship with sex might change after leaving a religion. Can you talk a little bit about that before we talk about what your newest project is?
Yeah, we surveyed 14,560 people, and they were all secular. There were no religious people in it, and it was all an online survey. It wasn't, you know, national sample, random or anything, but it was the first time anybody's actually asked secularists about their sex lives. And we found out a lot of interesting things, as we discussed earlier. The main thing was that when you leave religion, you lose a lot of guilt. Many people lose all their guilt around sex and sexuality, and it allows them to enjoy themselves a lot more.
Excellent. So that was your sort of the research study that you did. Now, was your plan always to write a book?
Yeah, I was actually in the process of writing my new book, Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality. I was in the process of writing that when I realized nobody's really asked secularists about their sex lives. And it seemed like such an obvious thing to do before you write a book like this.
It's good to have data.
Absolutely.
And it was. I thought it would be. So I got this research and look around, and ask it, and there's nobody had done any research on it. So that left me, and you know, I'm skilled at that kind of research. So I went ahead and put up the survey with the help of other bloggers, especially Greta Christina, PZ Myers, some of them. And it was very successful. I'm to this day still amazed at how successful that was. And then it went viral, and we got, I think since I talked to you guys, that darn survey, I was getting phone calls and emails from journalists in South Africa and Russia and Chile and wow. and Japan. And there was a month there last June when I was doing nothing, just about nothing but answering reporters' questions about the survey. It went viral. And we even made it into Playboy. I don't know if you heard that, but
no, I did not hear that.
Yeah. I assume that was a pictorial of
yeah,
you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm in Playboy with my clothes on. So some people think that
listeners
would,
will be so disappointed.
I know, that's less.
Might hurt sales if I was there. So anyway, the survey itself was it's actually only one chapter in the whole book. But it's an important chapter because it really gives us a baseline to look at what is sexuality like if you subtract religion from it. I have one chapter titled "You Can Take Religion Out of Sex, but You Can't Take Sex Out of Religion."
Mm-hmm.
And the thesis of the book is that religion distorts. I mean, it's a subtitle. Religion actually distorts our view of our own sexuality, of other people's sexuality, of our bodies. It has pervasive effects on us that we do not realize. It's like we're fish swimming in a polluted stream, and we have no idea it's polluted until we get out into fresh water. Well, I wanted to show people what the fresh water looks like. There's no need for us, especially secularists, there's no need for us to carry around some of the guilt and puritanical notions about sex and sexuality that our culture forces on us.
So I see your book is actually available for pre-sale already on places like Amazon.
Yeah.
And it claims that the book ventures into territories that have never been examined before. Can you give us some examples of that?
Yeah, I don't think anybody's ever really looked at the disconnect between religious behavior and beliefs. I don't think everybody's really looked at that in the kind of detail that I'm looking at here. I don't think anybody's ever looked at the biological. I really try to give a good biological baseline in the book around here's what human sexuality probably looks like if it doesn't have any religion involved in it. Now, it's kind of hard to believe because almost every culture on the face of the earth has got some level of religion. But there's ways to subtract religion out because we can look at a lot of other cultures. And I do. I take some key cultures and look at them, like the Muoso in China. I look at them, and they're a matriarchal culture that has no such thing. They don't even have a word for husband or wife. Marriage is not a part of that culture. Well, if you heard the Christian right talk, marriage was the most important thing on the face of the planet. Human beings couldn't exist without it. And yet the Muoso are thousands of years old, and they don't even have a word for husband or wife or marriage in their culture. The girl, when she gets to be 12 or 13 and goes into menarche, is allowed to have her own room, and the room has an outside door, and she can invite any lovers she wants in and out. And the only rule is the man has to be out before dawn.
Wow.
And who the father is irrelevant because the uncles and aunts are who raise the children. So the whole idea of fatherhood even is foreign to that particular culture. And there's cultures like this in different configurations all over the world. And when you start realizing human sexuality is a vast, enormous subject with enormously different practices from one culture to the other, and yet we still survive for tens of thousands, even millions of years without Jesus looking at what we're doing in the bedroom. Mm-hmm. It really makes a lot of difference. And that's what I think, Todd, I think I really try to do is, what does it look like if you take religion out of sexuality? And that's what I think is unique about the book.
Daryl, if there was one thing that our listeners would want to know that would make them want to pick this book up and read it, what would it be?
I've got one chapter called The Jesus Trap. And we all have known somebody who was perfectly normal, maybe even maybe even non-religious, and then one day suddenly they fall in love with somebody and they convert to their religion. They become a religious fanatic. What's going on there? And that's the Jesus trap. And every religion has got a psychological principle that I've named the Jesus trap, and it helps infect people with their with that particular religion. The Mormons are very good at it. Baptists, of course, and Catholics. Catholics force you to convert practically in order to become a Catholic, and Jews too, oftentimes. So there's techniques to get people to take on the religion, and then of course you have to take on the sexuality of that religion too. So I'd say the last five chapters really deal with what can you do different? How can you talk? How can you think? I've got a chapter on how to change your thinking. What are some of the thought patterns you probably aren't even aware of that you use every day, and they interfere with your really seeing your sexuality as it is? One of the quotes I've got in the book, I love it. I stole it from a TED talk I heard sometime back, was you have to let go of who you should be in order to discover who you are. And I really explore this idea of the shoulds that our culture and our religions have put on us. And even if somebody was raised, let's say they were raised an atheist, they still have been raised in this polluted water, and they've been told you shouldn't talk about sex, you shouldn't admit you masturbate, you shouldn't admit you have sex outside of marriage or before marriage or any of that sort of stuff. So those are religious concepts. They are not secular concepts. And we need to reinvent our own secular language.
Yeah.
And get rid of the shoulds, because the shoulds allow religion to set the agenda. And it allows people to continue to demonize those who are not strictly following the definition of proper sex and marriage from the Christian side. And it's mostly Christian here. But it doesn't matter. It could be in India among Hindus, or it could be in Saudi Arabia among Muslims. Whatever the dominant culture is, they're gonna try and set the agenda around sexuality.
If we're gonna print up recruiting bumper stickers, would it be fair to say that humanists have better sex?
Yes, and our research seems to show that, with the exception of 2.2% in our research. 2.2% said that sex got worse, and we wanted to understand what that was all about. And that actually helped me write some of the chapters here. It got worse because when we have people say, "Well, when I told my wife that I was no longer interested in religion, I was atheist," she stopped sleeping with me.
So it sounds like you're saying that for the majority of people who leave religion and come into atheism or humanism, whatever you want to call it, they have better sex. The people who answer sort of negative to that, it's not that they're not having better sex; they're just not having as much sex. So it's,
yeah, that's right.
They're kind of two different answers, kind of.
Yeah, because the it's the partners, the compatibility between two partners.
Right.
And we also found in our research that the more compatible the two partners were around religiosity, the better the sex. So if you got a person who was a Unitarian and an atheist, they were getting as good a sex as anybody.
Right.
If you were an atheist and an Episcopalian, you'd probably be doing pretty well too. But if you weren't an atheist married to a Catholic, things weren't too good.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, it went downhill pretty fast after that, and with other religions.
All right. Well, Dr. Ray, thank you so much once again for being on our show.
My pleasure. And thank you for having me.
Best of luck on your book tour, and I hope that we'll see you soon.
Okay.
Bye. Thanks, Daryl.
That was Dr. Daryl Ray, author of Sex and God, How Religion Destroys Sexuality. You can find links to purchase this book, and you can also check out the dates and locations for Dr. Ray's book tour at his website, ipcpress.com. That's ipcpress.com.
You can also check out an organization Daryl founded, Recovering From Religion, which is online at recoveringfromreligion.org. And is spreading around the country to help support people as they leave religion.
Daryl is a lot of fun. I love having him on the show, Todd. How about you?
Yeah, I wish there were more Dough Arrays out there, but fortunately, we got lots of awesome, enthusiastic people, and we're actually going to have quite a few of them at the upcoming American Humanist Association conference in New Orleans.
That's right, Todd. This is number 71 for us.
So the conference is June 7th through 10th, coming up this year in New Orleans, Louisiana. And that Sunday morning, when I'm sure everybody will be wide-eyed and bushy-tailed, we're going to be doing a live recording of the Humanist Hour, and we'll be featuring some of the top speakers at the conference. So that should be a lot of fun. You should come and check it out.
Yeah.
And see, get to experience some of the outtakes live.
Exactly.
We can't hide them there.
No, we certainly can't, Todd. So listeners, you can learn more about that conference. You can register. You can get all the information about where it is, when it is, who's going to be there, who we're giving awards to at conference.americanhumanist.org.
Excellent. And something else coming up that's big is the Reason Rally. And just wanted to mention that there's a couple of big new guests that have been announced that'll be speaking there. We now have Adam Savage, the co-host of Mythbusters.
Very cool.
Musician Tim Minchin is going to be there in DC on March 24th, 2012 on the National Mall. And we also now have Paul Provenza, the comedian, who will be doing the MC work for the day.
That's awesome.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, I can't wait. So listeners, for that, you can check out their website, reasonrally.org.
Well, Jess, thanks for another great show.
Hey, Todd, thank you for another great show. And listeners, thanks for joining us for another episode of The Humanist Hour. Don't forget, check us out at thehumanisthour.org, and we will talk to you next month.